Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier. It's Monday, September 27th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. It's going to be a warmer day today. Our high will be 87 degrees under mostly sunny skies, winds from the north-northwest, 4 to 8 miles per hour. Tonight, we go down to 56 degrees under a clear sky. As we look around the region today, mostly sunny and warm today, with temperatures approaching the record of 89 set in 1954. Clear tonight, very warm tomorrow and Wednesday, with plenty of sunshine. Thursday, we'll have a thunderstorm in spots. The sun rose this morning at 7:02 a.m., and it sets tonight at 6:58 p.m., marking a day with less than 12 hours of sunlight. Let's turn to the front page now and see what we have for stories. We have Wartburg President Will Retire, Gift Aims to Prevent Violence, and Building Connections will be our first story to read today. Before we start reading that article, we have the word for the day, and it is introduced with a photograph of a flock of birds over a bridge, and the caption says, "A flock of starlings murmurate, fly in swooping, intricately coordinated patterns through the sky from atop a grain elevator recently in Waterloo." So the next time you see a flock of birds flying in that amazingly coordinated way and making patterns in the sky, you'll know that that's a murmuration. Now back to our first story. Building Connections is the goal for Waterloo Community Foundation new director, Aaron Tink. And the story is filed by Melody Parker and begins with a photograph of Aaron Tink, Waterloo. Aaron Tink has been named executive director at the Waterloo Community Foundation. She has spent the last 7 years with Love, Inc., a local nonprofit, serving the last 3 years as its executive director. At her previous position, she was dedicated to building community partnerships and donor relationships, as well as organizational management. Now, she wants to take those responsibilities a step further. Quote, "It's the concierge idea that you can be the best at understanding what is happening in the community and connect the donor population to what's happening in the community and where their dollars are best spent," Tink said. Quote, "People have such a beautiful desire to make an impact and put their donations to best use. It's exciting for me to connect donors with what matters most to them," unquote. Board President Wilford Johnson said in a press release, quote, "We were very impressed with Erin's background, her enthusiasm for Waterloo, and the experience she brings to our organization. As an accredited community foundation, Erin will lead our efforts to grow our endowments and our capacity to engage in community affairs. As our asset base grows, together, we will assure that Waterloo is served now and in the future," unquote. The original Waterloo Civic Foundation was founded in 1956 and later was expanded and converted into an area foundation serving counties in northeast Iowa. In 2014, a group of longtime Waterloo residents, including former Waterloo Mayor Tim Hurley, Joe Vitch, Mike Young, and Rick Young, decided the community could support a Waterloo-focused foundation. In 2015, the new Waterloo Community Foundation was incorporated with the purpose of providing a conduit for past, present, and future Waterloo residents to invest or bequeath funds specifically to enhance Waterloo and the immediate area. It is governed by a 14-member board of directors. Tink replaces retiring executive director Michelle Tiemeyer. Tiemeyer led the foundation in receiving accreditation with the National Standards for U.S. Community Foundations, established 9 endowments, 9 scholarship programs, 14 donor-advised funds, and other funds such as the Racial Equity Fund and Believe Waterloo. During the pandemic, the foundation launched the First Responders Fund, benefited the Waterloo Police and Fire Departments, People's Community Health Clinic, Unity Point, and Mercy One. Since 2016, the foundation has awarded grants totaling over $289,000. Quote, Michelle has done a fabulous job in getting support for the foundation from pillars in the community. It's fun to learn from her and build on what she and the board have created, Tink said. All donor funds are invested in local financial institutions. No minimum contribution is required, which makes the foundation somewhat unique, Tink said. Quote, many foundations have minimum requirements, but we remain open to any size investment. Our intention is to make it possible for investors of any size to invest in the community, unquote. Organizations and charities in Waterloo, and those serving Waterloo and its citizens, are beneficiaries of funding, including grants to nonprofits for general support, capacity building grants, project support, endowments, innovation grants, scholarships, and challenge match grants, she explained. Quote, donors want to know their dollars have an impact on the community they love, that investments are carefully managed, and that every dollar counts, unquote. Tink has called Waterloo home for 10 years. A Seattle native, she met and married metro area native Jesse Tink and moved here when he accepted a position at Prairie Lakes Church in Cedar Falls. He is now executive pastor of leadership. The couple have two children, Jude and Ellie. Quote, as a transplant, I'm surprised at how I feel so connected to Waterloo. It feels like home. I like that this community has so much to offer, including industry, the arts, and activities, and diversity usually found in larger cities, Tink said. Quote, people here really care about their community, and we're always better when we work together, unquote. For more information about the Waterloo Community Foundation, call area code 319-883-6022 or email info@WLOOCommunityFoundation.org. The next story was filed by Courier staff. UNI's Center for Violence Prevention is renamed as a couple gives a $2 million gift. And the story begins with a photograph with the caption, Patricia and O.J. Thompson are thanked by University of Northern Iowa President Mark Nook on September 17th after the naming of the Patricia A. Thompson Center for Violence Prevention was announced. Cedar Falls. The University of Northern Iowa's Center for Violence Prevention has been renamed in honor of Patricia Thompson, who, along with her husband, gave a $2 million gift to support its mission. The new name, a Patricia A. Thompson Center for Violence Prevention, was recently announced during a ceremony in conjunction with the center's 10-year anniversary. Thompson has worked for decades on behalf of survivors of abuse. Patricia and her husband, O.J. Thompson, donated the money in support of the center's efforts to build the capacity of Iowa schools, victim service agencies, law enforcement, and other institutions to systematically implement best practices in bystander-based prevention education. The endowed gift will provide operational support as well as sustained funding for the Thompson Scholars Program, which since 2016 has funded student internships with violence prevention organizations and agencies providing direct services to survivors of abuse. Quote, we want this gift to build and sustain the center's important work into the future, Patricia Thompson said in a news release. Quote, we've been really impressed with the students' dedication and work ethic, and we wanted to contribute to provide meaningful experiences for them through the Thompson Scholars Program, unquote. This is an apparent societal need, and it is timely, O.J. Thompson added, noting that the issue of violence prevention cuts across political lines. Quote, we hope others will step up to support the center, unquote. We are overwhelmed with gratitude to the Thompsons for their generosity, Alan Heisterkamp, director of the Center for Violence Prevention, said in a news release. Quote, the legacy they've provided will build our capacity to educate and serve constituents for the next decade and beyond, helping to make Iowa's schools and communities safer and more supportive for the next generation of young people, unquote. The UNI Center for Violence Prevention was established in 2011, and over the last decade has shaped the landscape of violence prevention at the state and national level by educating and empowering young people to prevent bullying, gender-based violence, and other harmful behaviors. The Thompsons have received numerous awards for their philanthropy over the years, including for their support of several higher educational institutions. Patricia received her master's degree in counseling from UNI in 1986, leading to a career as a family therapist and later as executive director for the First Citizens Bank Charitable Foundation, where O.J. served as chairman of the board. The Thompson's gift was made through the UNI Foundation. For more information about the Center for Violence Prevention, visit cvp.uni.edu. The Courier staff also filed this next story. Wartburg's President Colson to retire at the end of the academic year. And it begins with a photograph of Darryl Colson in front of a bookcase. Waverly, Darryl Colson, the 17th president of Wartburg College, will retire at the end of the academic year, bringing to close a 13-year tenure that started on July 1, 2009. Quote, "When we consider only the satisfaction that we derive from work, I'd likely never retire, and yet we learned many years ago from a more experienced presidential couple that one of the most important and yet difficult decisions a president must make is when to step aside and pass the baton to another," said Colson. Colson and his wife, Christy, will return to Louisiana following his retirement. Quote, "Loving a place as much as we love Wartburg makes leaving difficult," unquote. Colson said leaving now, as the college prepares to finalize its new strategic plan and fundraising initiatives, will serve the college well as it looks toward the future. Quote, "What a propitious time for the new president to join our community and to pursue those ends," he said. "The college's future is bright now as we've ever seen it," unquote. During his tenure, the Board of Regents adopted the strategic plan, quote, "Living Our Learning, Claiming Our Calling, Transforming Tomorrow," that ended in 2020. The college community generously supported the Transforming Tomorrow campaign, which raised more than $89 million, including nearly $34 million in scholarships. The campaign also helped fund 6 endowed chairs and professorships, the construction of the Knife Outdoor Athletics Pavilion, and the renovation of Clinton Hall into McCoy Living and Learning Center. In 2017, Colson announced the formation of Focus on the Future, a constituent engagement initiative that led to additional faculty and academic opportunities in the engineering program, new and deeper relationships with community partners, and an increased commitment to ensuring that at-risk students have the same opportunities to succeed. The initiative also led to the development of the Department of Health and Human Performance, which houses the new exercise science major. Wartburg has developed several new majors and areas of concentration, including the college's first Bachelor of Science degree in engineering and its first 2 master's level programs in music therapy and leadership. The college also entered a long-term agreement with Wartburg Theological Seminary in Dubuque to offer an accelerated ministry degree program that allows participants to complete their bachelor's degree and Master of Divinity in just 6 years. Quote, "You only have to look around campus to see what he has accomplished," said Mike McCoy, chair of the Board of Regents. Quote, "Under his leadership and guidance, we have the college positioned very well for the future," unquote. McCoy praised Colson for his leadership through tough times. After taking the reins just as the county emerged from the Great Recession, Colson has led Wartburg through budget cuts and faculty and staff reductions, all while strategically allocating dollars in areas that could grow revenue for the school. His leadership also has been instrumental navigating the ongoing pandemic. Quote, I don't think he's gotten enough credit for his ability to lead the college through these times, McCoy said. He's had to make tough decisions, but he's always been gracious about them and transparent about them. People may not have liked the decisions that he made, but he kept them informed, unquote. Colson was a member of the Waverly Economic Development Commission, Grow Cedar Valley, and the Allen College Board, as well as the vice chair of the Unity Point Allen Health System Board. He also serves on the board of directors for the Iowa College Foundation, the board of directors of the Iowa Association of Independent Colleges and Universities, and the NetView Advisory Board, among others. In the coming weeks, the Board of Regents will begin the process of hiring a search firm and launching a national search for the 18th president of the college. Turning the page now, we see that we're in the Northeast Iowa Area Escapades section. Here are a few of the events, shenanigans, and goings on worth checking out this week in the Northeast Iowa area. Tonight, Jimmy Buffett's escapade to Margaritaville at GBPAC. The Broadway musical is at 7:30 p.m. tonight in the Great Hall at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center in Cedar Falls. The new Broadway musical will set Parrot Heads and Island Time with fun and music written by one of the popular music's greatest storytellers. Then tomorrow, Tuesday, September 28th, UNI Jazz Combos to perform. University of Northern Iowa's Jazz Combos will offer a concert of jazz standards and new arrangements. Music begins at 7:30 p.m. in Bengston Auditorium at Russell Hall on the UNI campus in Cedar Falls. It's free and open to the public. Remember the drive-in movie? Tim Coleman will discuss the rise and fall of drive-in movie theaters at a Cedar Valley Historical Society meeting on Tuesday. The event begins at 7 p.m. at the Grout Museum, 503 South Street. Refreshments will be served following the presentation. Cost is $3 for adults, $2 for children. Anyone interested in joining the Cedar Valley Historical Society can contact Greg Bravender at 296-3019. On Thursday, September 30th, artist Gary Kelly sits in his studio on Main Street in Cedar Falls and talks about the release of his first graphic novel, The Moon of the Snowblind. Gary Kelly and Scott Cowaletti, four cinematic masterpieces. Nationally known illustrator Gary Kelly and University of Northern Iowa Professor Emeritus Scott Cowaletti will discuss four major films from both visual and narrative perspectives from 9 to 11:30 a.m. The Keep On Learning program, Wartburg College's adult education program, will take place in the Heritage Room at Saman Student Center on the Waverly campus at 100 Wartburg Boulevard. Coffee is available at 9 a.m., followed by the presentation from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. Pre-registration is not required. If you enjoy the first class and plan to continue attend subsequent classes on Thursday mornings, the fee is $40, payable at the second class. For more information, visit www.wartburg.edu/KOL. Surprise, night out in Cedar Falls. Grab your favorite peeps for a night out from 5 to 8:30 p.m., strolling, shopping, and eating out in the Cedar Falls downtown district. Favorite merchants will have surprises in store. Glaze a ceramic pumpkin. Welcome fall by glazing a keepsake ceramic jack-o'-lantern for fall decoration at the Waterloo Center for the Arts, 225 Commercial Street. Class is at 6 p.m. The pumpkins are locally made. Space is limited. Registered at 291-4490. Cost is $24 for members, $30 for non-members. Final Thursday reading series. Dave Hoining and Roger Hellman are co-authors of several novels, including In the Blood, Hammond Falls, and the Killing Snow will be featured readers at the May Latta Hall at the Hearst Center for the Arts, 304 West Searley Boulevard, Cedar Falls. There is an open mic at 7:15 p.m. with sign-up at 7 o'clock p.m., followed by the featured reading. Event is free and open to the public. On Friday, October 1st, and Saturday, October 2nd, raise a glass and cheer Waverly's Oktoberfest. This two-day family-friendly event takes place in Coleman Park at Bremer Avenue and 1st Street Northwest. Hours are 4 to 11:30 p.m. Friday and 11 a.m. to midnight Saturday. Opening ceremony with a tapping of the keg is at 6 o'clock p.m. Friday. There will be a family fun zone with pony and train rides, dance lessons, and dance performance by the UNI International Dance Team, a keg toss competition, beverage garden with German and locally brewed beers, food vendors and games. Fireworks over the Cedar River will blast off at 8 o'clock p.m., sponsored by Nestle. Friday's music will feature the Eisenachers, Barefoot Becky, and the Ivanhoe Dutchman, Barflies, and That 80s Band. On Saturday, flights of Waverly Oktoberfest keg beers will be available from 11 a.m. to 3 o'clock p.m. There will be a bags tournament, a hammerslagen contest, a craze local homebrewers testing event at 3 o'clock p.m., a stein hoisting competition at 5:30 p.m., and hammered schlagen contest at 6:30 p.m. Music will include the Eisenachers, Melex Fisherman Band, Jim Busta Band, and the Oktoberfest Singers, Nevertheless, and Pop Rocks. Saturday, October 2nd, Fall Craft and Vendor Show at AmVets Post 49. More than 25 vendors are expected to participate in the Fall Craft and Vendor Show from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at AmVets Post 49, 1934 Irving Street, Cedar Falls. There will be music and food as well. The show will raise funds to purchase hats for veterans at the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown. $5 a bag book sale at Waterloo Public Library. It's back! The Friends of Waterloo Public Library's book sale. Just $5 will buy you a bag of used books at this sale on Saturday from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. in the library basement. Shoppers can fill up a bag supplied by the Friends with your choice of books. If you buy two bags at $5 each, you receive a third bag of books for free. Friday, October 1st and Saturday, October 2nd, Vintage Bazaar to benefit historic houses. Friends of the Grout Historic Houses will host a Vintage Bazaar Friday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon at the Snowden House, 306 Washington Street, Waterloo. Friends will offer a variety of treasures for sale, including vintage furnishings, books, glassware, and more. Profits will go directly to the upkeep of the Grout Museum District's historic Rensselaer Russell House and Snowden House. Also Saturday, October 2nd and Sunday, October 3rd, the Great Iowa Fall Ride by Ragbri. Check your tires and grab your helmet and join other bike riders for the Great Iowa Fall Ride on Cedar Valley Nature Trail. Hours are 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. This next story was filed by Melody Parker. Kaleidoscope Series returns to live performances in spring 2022 at Gallagher Bluedorn, Cedar Falls. The Kaleidoscope Series at Gallagher Bluedorn Performing Arts Center is going live and in person for school children next spring. Schools can reserve tickets now for 10 new shows, a mix of old and new classics. Kids are generally delighted by Kaleidoscope shows and have a great day of learning. Going back to live and in-person shows means kids will rediscover the fun of live theater performances, said Steve Kerrigan, GBPAC Executive Director. Tickets can be requested online via Unitix by clicking the order link at www.unitix.com. www.gbpac.com. The series is designed to create a deeper understanding of classroom subjects and serves as a supplementary tool in classroom learning. Performances address such complex issues such as race and poverty. Through live performances at the Great Hall, Kaleidoscope has reached more than 625,000 school children since its inception in 2000. Kaleidoscope went virtual last year during the coronavirus pandemic, which proved successful. Although the original intent was to provide tools for teachers to use in their online teaching, the reach extended far beyond Cedar Valley in Northeast Iowa. Quote, teachers were looking for help on teaching, but towards the end of the series, we found that our programs were being purchased organically from all over by people who found the programming useful and entertaining, he explained, including students, teachers, and families from throughout North America and abroad. The fall Kaleidoscope season will be virtual, and virtual performances will continue to be in the mix going forward. If a school group can't make a field trip to a live show, we can say, here's an alternative. It's a way to serve more people and meet them where they're at, Kerrigan said. Premiering live shows in February rather than fall was us being cautious, said Kerrigan. Quote, teachers are still anxious about COVID, so, frankly, we decided to avoid the challenge. We want everyone to be comfortable and see things progressing so we can go all the way back to normal, unquote. Featured shows are The Pout Pout Fish, The Very Hungry Caterpillar, Rosie Revere Engineer and Friends, The Little Red Hen, Doug Mann the Musical, School Rock Live, Secrets of Space, Freedom Riders, Drumline Live, and The Reminders. Performances are directed at various age groups. For example, The Pout Pout Fish, based on the picture book series, is suitable for pre-kindergarten through first grade students, while the science-oriented Secrets of Space is for middle school students, and The Reminders, an up-and-coming hip-hop group, is for older students. Kaleidoscope shows link directly to core curricula in schools, so it reminds teachers that kids are getting more out of attending Kaleidoscope show than just a field trip, Kerrigan said. Theater is a valuable resource in getting children enthused about learning to read, to use their imaginations, and recognize characters that give people a voice, as well as improve math skills through music and dance. Attending multiple performances during a student's school life also can improve critical thinking skills. Quote, some kids see and learn, some kids do and learn, and some kids hear and learn. Theater is an effective way to teach those core literacy and math skills, and it's fun, Kerrigan said. For more information, or to see the complete season details, go to www.gbpac.com. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, September 27th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's see what the sports page has to offer today. In Iowa football, Cedar Falls' Jack Campbell was all over the field Saturday for the Hawkeyes, story filed by Steve Batterson. And it begins with a photograph with the caption, Iowa linebacker Jack Campbell intercepts a pass during the Hawkeyes' win over Wisconsin last season at Kinnick Stadium, Iowa City. The football seems to have a way of finding Jack Campbell. The Iowa middle linebacker found himself in the middle of action in the Hawkeyes' 24-14 win Saturday over Colorado State. The junior from Cedar Falls finished with a career-high 18 tackles in the game, recording 9 in the first quarter and another 4 before Iowa headed to the locker room at halftime to figure out how to overcome a 14-7 halftime deficit. Did it feel like an 18-tackle game? Quote, not really, Campbell said. We just needed to make plays, unquote. Campbell provided Iowa with that in the second half, recording his second fumble recovery in the Hawkeyes' last three games at the 6-yard line. Unlike his scoop and score at Iowa State, Campbell simply smothered the football that Hiya Black had jarred loose. On the next snap, Tyrone Tracy Jr. carried the ball into the end zone to tie the game at 14-14 with 8 minutes 17 seconds to go in the third quarter. A little over 2 minutes later, Campbell's handiwork had helped move the Hawkeyes ahead to stay. Quote, "It doesn't surprise me," said linebacker Seth Benson about Campbell's play. Benson, who completed Campbell's game with 11 tackles himself, and Campbell's focus on fundamentals, puts him in a position to make plays when the opportunity is there. Quote, "The way he goes about his business every day, that's why he does what he does," Benson said. Quote, "It's the way he attacks the week. What happens on Saturday is just a byproduct of what he does the rest of the week," unquote. Campbell's tone-setting work, which included a pair of pass breakups, helped the Hawkeye limit Colorado State to 250 yards of offense. Through 4 games, Campbell now leads Iowa with 43 tackles. The Rams were limited to 95 yards on the ground, the fourth Hawkeye opponent to finish with fewer than 100 rushing yards in a game. Defensive end Zach Van Valkenburg said the play of Campbell and the rest of the players in the Hawkeyes' back seven have helped a young Iowa defensive line grow. Quote, "They're doing a great job. Everybody's getting to the football," Van Valkenburg said. Quote, "We needed a good second half. We came out and played our brand of football. It's what we strive for every week," unquote. Campbell welcomed the chance to do what he could to make that happen. Quote, "The coaches, they talk about us playing to a high standard," Campbell said. "That means something. We should try to play to that standard every snap. That's the goal, always." Iowa-Penn State said the starting time for Iowa's next home football game was announced Saturday. The Hawkeyes will host Penn State at 3 p.m. on Saturday, October 9th. The game will be televised by Fox, making it 6 times in the first 7 games of the season Iowa will kick off between 2:30 and 3:30 p.m. The only exception is next Friday, when the Hawkeyes play at Maryland at 7 p.m. Iowa has already announced that all tickets for the Penn State game have been sold, the first sellout of the season at Kinnick Stadium. Next, this story filed by Ralph D. Russo of the Associated Press. Loss ends Clemson's 97-week streak in top 10. Clemson tumbled to number 25 in the Associated Press college football poll on Sunday, snapping its streak of 97 straight weeks in the top 10. The Tigers, 2-for-2, lost for the second time this season Saturday, falling in double overtime to North Carolina State, and dropped 16 points from number 9 in the top 25, which is presented by Regions Bank. Clemson's top 10 streak was tied with Alabama for the longest current run in college football and second longest in the history of the AP poll, behind Miami's 137 from 1985 to 93. The Crimson Tide remained number 1 with 58 first-place votes out of 62. Number 2, Georgia, received the remaining 4 first-place votes. Oregon stayed number 3. Penn State moved up 2 spots to number 4. Iowa held at number 5. And Oklahoma slipped 2 spots to number 6. Cincinnati moved up a spot to number 7. And Arkansas jumped 8 spots to number 8 after beating Texas A&M. The Razorbacks have their best ranking since they were number 8 early in the 2012 season. That season, Arkansas lost its second game of the season to Louisiana Monroe and was never ranked again. The Razorbacks had finished 5th the season before under Bobby Petrino. Number 9, Notre Dame, and Florida rounded out the top 10. Pool points. Clemson did manage to extend its streak of weeks ranked to number 107, the third longest active streak behind Alabama at 218 and Ohio State at 150. The Buckeyes' streak does not include polls in which they were ineligible during the 2020 season because the Big Ten was not planning to play during the coronavirus pandemic. Alabama's current streak of poll appearances is second all-time to Nebraska's 348 from the 1981 to 2002 season. They're in. After six ranked teams lost this weekend, four to unranked opponents, four new teams entered the rankings of the first time this season. Number 19, Oklahoma State, improved to 4-0 by beating Kansas State. The Cowboys finished last season ranked. Number 21, Baylor, is 4-0 after upsetting Iowa State at home and is ranked for the first time since the final 2019 poll. Number 23, Carolina State, 3-1, snapped an eight-game losing streak against Clemson to move into the ranking. The Wolfpack was ranked briefly at number 23 last season. And number 24, Wake Forest, is 4-0 for the first time since 2019, when the Demon Deacons were ranked for a total of 5 weeks with a peak of number 19. That's the only season Wake has been ranked since 2008. They're out. Two teams that started the season in the top 10 are now unranked. Iowa State started at number 7, its best ranking in school history, after finishing 9th in 2020, but now sits at 2-2 and unranked. North Carolina was number 10 to start the season, but fell out after being routed by Georgia Tech to fall to 2-2. Wisconsin began the season at number 12, but after losing to Penn State and Notre Dame to fall to 1-2, is unranked. And finally, Kansas State spent 1 week in the rankings and dropped out. In the Iowa Football Notebook, Iowa freshman receiver Johnson made first collegiate catch count. Story filed by Steve Batterson. Iowa City. Keegan Johnson made his first collegiate catch count on Saturday. The true freshman receiver broke free from a single coverage and wrapped his arms around a 43-yard touchdown pass to provide Iowa with his first points in a 24-14 victory over Colorado State. Quote, "It wasn't planned that way. Things just sort of worked out," Johnson said. "I was on the same page with Spencer, and I'm glad it played out that way it did. Spencer knows I can get open. I just hope to get off the line cleanly," and Spencer threw a great ball. Johnson pulled it in just beyond the 5-yard line along the right sideline to put the Hawkeyes on the board with 13 minutes, 45 seconds remaining in the first half, following a scoreless opening quarter. The catch was one of two Johnson made against the Rams, the second covering 49 yards later in the second quarter, just before Petras threw his first interception of the season. Johnson said Iowa's passing game is continuing to evolve. Quote, "I felt like we took a step forward today," he said. To do that, Bellevue, Nebraska native had to deal with some elements in addition to the Colorado State defense. Johnson had the sun in his eyes before recording his first career catch for the Hawkeyes. Quote, "I lost the ball for like 3 seconds," Johnson said. "Luckily, it popped back into my view, and I was able to make the catch," unquote. The deep ball, Petras' 43-yard touchdown pass to Johnson, was the second longest touchdown pass of the junior's career, and one of 5 passes of 20 yards or more he threw Saturday. Quote, "We have a goal of having 5 explosive plays every game, and we had yet to meet that until today," Petras said. Colorado State's decision to go with one-on-one coverage facilitated that. "If people want to go over one against us, we feel like we have the receivers who can go out and make plays," Petras said. Petras' longest career touchdown toss came late in the third quarter of the Hawkeyes' win over Wisconsin last season when he connected with Emir Smith-Marset on a 53-yard scoring play. In addition to be Johnson's first career reception, the connection was Iowa's second longest pass play this season. Petras hit Nico Regani with a 48-yard pass in the Hawkeyes' win over Kent State. Prior to Johnson's catch, Iowa's longest touchdown pass in 2021 was Charlie Jones's 26-yard catch late in the first half of the Iowa State win. The spin zone. Iowa's Sam Laporta was flagged for excessive celebration after he spun the football on the turf in the end of zone following 27-yard touchdown reception at the third quarter. Quote, "At the end of the day, I was having fun celebrating. I didn't know it would be a penalty, and it was too bad I had to learn that," Laporte said. "You have 70,000 people looking at you. You're feeling good. It just kind of happened." Iowa coach Kurt Ferentz said the flag caught him by surprise as well. "Learned a lesson. The ball was on the 50. Next thing we knew," Ferentz said, referencing the enforcement that followed the penalty, "front five change." True freshman Connor Colby made his starting debut on the Iowa offensive line Saturday, opening at right guard in place of Justin Britt. The change was the first in the Hawkeyes' starting front five this season and was precipitated by a minor injury to Britt, who was in uniform for the Colorado State game. With redshirt freshman Mason Richmond starting at left tackle, Iowa opened with two freshmen in its offensive line for the first time since Tristan Wirfs and Alec Jackson opened together in 2017. Kyler Schott saw action as a backup to Colby as he continues his return to action following a preseason foot injury, streaking. With Minnesota's 14-10 loss Saturday at Bowling Green, Iowa now owns the longest active non-conference win streak in college football. The Hawkeyes extended their opening win streak to 15 games with the win over Colorado State. Iowa's last loss to a non-conference opponent came in the 2017 Outback Bowl when Florida defeated the Hawkeyes 30-3. And now Doug Ferguson of the Associated Press files this story. Americans finish off Ryder Cup route. Sheboygan, Wisconsin. The Americans won back the Ryder Cup and perhaps a whole lot more Sunday, sending a strong message with their youngest team by giving Europe its worst loss ever. They never lost a session. They rode the experience of Dustin Johnson, who won all five of his matches, and leaned on six Ryder Cup newcomers who combined for a 14-4-3 record. Daniel Berger won the final hole in the final match for the final point in a 19-9 victory, breaking by a half point the record margin since Europe became part of the Ryder Cup in 1979. Quote, "This is a new era," U.S. Captain Steve Stricker said. "These guys are young. They want it. They're motivated. They came here determined to win. I can see it in their eyes," unquote. And he could see it in the scoreboards across Whistling Straits, filled with American red all afternoon in a performance that was dominant from the opening session Friday morning. Scotty Scheffler, one of six Ryder Cup rookies for the U.S., took down the number one player in the world with a 4-3 victory over John Rahm. Scheffler won the opening four holes and birdied five of the first six. He was among three rookies who were unbeaten this week. The clinching blow came from Colin Morikawa at 24, the youngest player on the team and already a two-time major champion. He made a three-foot birdie putt on the 17th hole that assured the Americans at least the 14.5 points they needed. They wanted more. Quote, "I woke up this morning and I was trying to tell the guys, let's get to 20 points because this is going to be the next era of the Ryder Cup team for the U.S. side," Patrick Cantlay said after he completed an unbeaten week with a win over Shane Lowry. Quote, "We've got a lot of young guys. I think they're going to be on teams for a long time, and I wanted to send a message," unquote. Tony Finau had said on the eve of these matches that this was the big one because Europe had won 9 of the last 12 and the Americans had so many fresh faces without any lasting scars from watching Europe celebrate so much over the years. It was a chance to change the culture and this was a massive step. The gallery saved one of its loudest cheers for Stricker, the Wisconsin native who has been at the helm of two blowouts. He guided the U.S. team to a 19-11 victory in the President's Cup in 2017 and added his signature piece at Whistling Straits. Johnson became the first American since Larry Nelson in 1979 to go 5-0, completing his perfect week by beating Paul Casey in a match he never trailed. Casey, Matt Fitzpatrick, and Bernd Weisberger all failed to win a point. Rory McIlroy and Ian Poulter, part of the backbone of the European experience, didn't win a match until singles, and by then it was too late. The Americans were young, yes, and very good, with four of the top five in the world ranking, and they finally played like it. These four players, Johnson, Morikawa, Cantley, and Xander Schauffele, combined for a 14-1-2 record. Quote, "It's not just the strongest U.S. team I've seen, but they all played well this week," Lee Westwood said. "Everybody performed and turned up this week. Looks like they are a team." Stricker wasn't the only one in tears. McIlroy led Europe off again and gave Schauffele his first loss of the week. It wasn't nearly enough. All day long, the shores of Lake Michigan, the outcome was inevitable. McIlroy teared up in his interview when talking about how much the Ryder Cup means to him. Quote, "I've never really cried or got emotional over what I've done as an individual. I couldn't give an expletive," he said on NBC. "But this team, to see Sergio break records, to see John Rahm come into his own this week, to see one of my best friends, Shane Lowry, make his Ryder Cup debut, all that, it's phenomenal. I'm disappointed that I didn't contribute more this week," he said. "But in 2 years' time, we'll go again and give it another. So, sorry for swearing as well," unquote. As much as this was about a new generation of Americans, this looked to be an aging team of Europeans. They brought winning experience, but not nearly enough form. Garcia set the Ryder Cup record with 25 matches won in his career. Rahm was the star for Europe, living up to his billing as the number one player by making so many big putts. Both lost in singles. Garcia to Bryson DeChambeau, and Rahm ran to Scheffler, who delivered big moments of his own this week. There was little Europe could have done. The U.S. team was loaded and played like it. Quote, "They had a mission this week," Strickler said. "You could tell. The next step is winning on the road, which the Americans haven't done since 1993. Europe still has an 11-9-1 advantage since the Ryder Cup was expanded in 1979 to include the continent. Okay, now we have a recap of Sunday's football games. Chargers takeaway win in Kansas City. Story filed by the Associated Press. Kansas City, Missouri. The Chargers capitalized on four Kansas City turnovers, including Patrick Mahomes' second interception in the closing minutes and Justin Herbert's touchdown toss to Mike Williams, with 32 seconds to go, lifted Los Angeles to a 30-24 victory over the Chiefs on Sunday. Herbert finished with 281 yards passing and four touchdowns without an interception, out-dueling Mahomes in a matchup not only of two of the game's best young quarterbacks, but two teams expected to compete for the AFC West title. Williams finished with seven catches for 122 yards and two touchdowns. Austin Eckler and Keenan Allen also had touchdown grabs. Rams 34, Buccaneers 24. Matthew Stafford passed for 343 yards and four touchdowns as he outdueled Tom Brady and led Los Angeles to a home victory over Tampa Bay. Stafford's best pass of the game came early in the third quarter when he connected with a wide-open DeSean Jackson for a 75-yard score to extend Los Angeles' lead to 21-7. Ravens 19, Lions 17. Justin Tucker set an NFL record with a 66-yard field goal, bouncing it off the crossbar as time expired to give Baltimore a stunning victory in Detroit. The kick topped off the 64-yarder Mac Prater made for Denver in 2013. Saints 28, Patriots 13. Jameis Winston threw two touchdown passes and Malcolm Jenkins returned an interception for a score to lead New Orleans past New England in Foxborough, Massachusetts. Bengals 24, Steelers 10. Joe Burrow threw for 178 yards and three touchdowns, including two to rookie Ja'Marr Chase in Cincinnati's road victory over Pittsburgh. Browns 26, Bears 6. Myles Garrett recorded a franchise record 4.5 sacks on Justin Fields, and Cleveland brought down Chicago rookie quarterback 9 times, holding him to 1 net yard passing in his first NFL start. The host Browns held the Bears to 47 yards and 6 first downs. Falcons 17, Giants 14. Younghoe Koo kicked a 40-yard field goal on the final play to lift Atlanta over New York in East Rutherford, New Jersey, to give coach Arthur Smith his first NFL win. Matt Ryan hit passes of 28 yards to Cordarrelle Patterson and 25 to rookie tight end Kyle Pitts on the winning drive. Bills 43, Washington 21. Josh Allen quieted his early season critics and own self-doubts by throwing 4 touchdown passes and scoring another rushing in Buffalo's home victory over Washington. Allen finished 32 of 43 for 358 yards. Cardinals 31, Jaguars 19. Byron Murphy intercepted 2 passes, including one he returned for a touchdown following a botched trick play, and Arizona rallied to win in Jacksonville, Florida. Titans 25, Colts 16. Ryan Tannehill threw for 197 yards and 3 touchdowns to lead Tennessee past Indianapolis in Nashville. Derrick Henry ran for 113 yards, topping the 100-yard mark for a 6th straight division game. Vikings 30, Seahawks 17. Kirk Cousins threw 3 touchdown passes before halftime and guided 3 clock-draining field goal drives after that as Minnesota won its home opener, beating Seattle for the first time in 12 years. Broncos 26, Jets 0. Von Miller led a defense that sacked Zach Wilson 5 times, intercepted him twice, and limited the rookie to 160 yards passing in Denver's home victory over New York. Raiders 31, Dolphins 28 in overtime. Daniel Carlson's 22-yard field goal as time expired in overtime gave Las Vegas a home victory over Miami. Raiders quarterback Derek Carr found Bryson Edwards for 34 yards before Peyton Barber put together runs of 27 and 8 yards to put Las Vegas on the Dolphins 11 to start up the winning score. In the Around the League column, Andy Reid leaves with illness, Kansas City, Missouri. Chiefs coach Andy Reid quickly left Arrowhead Stadium with an illness after a 30-24 loss to the Los Angeles Chargers on Sunday, leaving assistant coach Dave Taub to handle questions following a second straight fourth quarter letdown. Reid was feeling ill, but coached the duration of the game, a team spokesman said, before NFL Network reported the 63-year-old coach went to the hospital in an ambulance as a precaution. The Chiefs did not provide additional comment. Jags 109-yard return, a record. Jacksonville. With Gus Johnson on the call for Fox Sports, you knew something crazy was going to happen. Jaguars receiver Jamal Agnew delivered. Arizona's Matt Prater attempted what would have been an NFL record 68-yard field goal at the end of the half, and it ended up leading to an NFL record tying 109-yard touchdown for the Jaguars. Agnew caught the short kick 9 yards deep and returned it the other way for a score and a 13-7 lead. U.S. has enough COVID vaccines for boosters, children. Associated Press. With more than 40 million doses of coronavirus vaccines available, U.S. health authorities said they're confident there will be enough for both qualified older Americans seeking booster shots and the young children for whom initial vaccines are expected to be approved in the not-too-distant future. The spike in demand, expected following last week's federal recommendation on booster shots, would be the first significant jump in months. More than 70 million Americans remain unvaccinated despite the enticement of lottery prizes, free food or gifts, and pleas from exhausted healthcare workers as the average number of deaths per day climbed to more than 1,900 in recent weeks. Federal and state health authorities said current supply and steady production of more doses can easily accommodate those seeking boosters or initial vaccination, avoiding a repeat of the frustratingly slow rollout of COVID-19 vaccines across the country earlier this year. Among the challenges states face is not ordering too many doses and letting them go to waste. Several states with low vaccination rates, including Idaho and Kansas, have reported throwing away thousands of expired doses or are struggling to use vaccines nearing expiration this fall. While most vaccines can stay on the shelf for months, once a vial is opened, the clock starts ticking. Vaccines are usable for only 6 to 12 hours, depending on the manufacturer, according to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, September 27th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And you may wish to stay tuned to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which will follow shortly. Thank you for listening to Your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.